Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Comic Source Podcast. I'm your host, Jace. This is your new Comics Wednesday episode for Wednesday, November 25th. It's the day before Thanksgiving, so I hope if everybody's traveling, you're being safe. Make sure you wear a mask if you're out in public. And if you're traveling in the car and you have a long trip, this is going to be a pretty decent sized episode, I think. I'm probably not going to go in as much depth as I normally do. Obviously, spoiler free, because you probably haven't had a chance to read your books. So hopefully you got a chance to hit up your comic shop before you headed out of town, or maybe you're headed home from college and you're going to hit up your local store for months and months of goodness, comic goodness that have been waiting for you. But either way, hope this episode keeps you entertained on your trip. As I say, be safe. And I'm going to go over 17 books, I think was the count, that are out today. It was a pretty big week. You know, normally, I think the week before Thanksgiving is a lighter week, but there were a ton of great books that came out today. So let's go ahead and get started with Action Comics. It is the finale. It's even called an epilogue, if you will. It is episode 1027 from writer Brian Michael Bendis. The art is by John Romita Jr., or the pencils rather, by Romita Jr. We have inks by Klaus Janson. Colors are by Brad Anderson, and letters are by Dave Sharp. So this is the finishing up the House of Kent epilogue. And I mentioned when I read the last issue that Bendis had finally gotten me interested. Like I finally was hooked enough in what was going on in Bendis's attempt to tell a crime noir story in Action Comics. I finally was hooked enough to want to know how it was all going to end up. So I was kind of surprised to find out that last issue, like when I opened this up, I was, wait, this is the epilogue. So when did it wrap up? Like last issue, there was all kinds of stuff left hanging. I'm not sure why this is an epilogue. It doesn't feel like an epilogue because Red Cloud is still out there. We have no answers about Leon. We have no answers about the Daily Planet. All that gets wrapped up here. So this is the end of the story. It's not an epilogue. It's not adding something on after you've already kind of had the climax. So that right away was confusing. And then I don't know, I guess based on the fact that Bendis is trying to wrap everything up neatly and calling this an epilogue, but really we're getting the conclusion of the story. It's really choppy. It's not paced well. And then the other thing is when you bring in Romita Jr. on art, who, you know, everybody knows I can't stand his style. His style has become lazy to me. It's not good storytelling. The transitions from panel to panel aren't good. A lot of times it's hard to even see what's going on or understand. And so when you bring in choppy pacing and then you have art that's not doing you any favors and it's like, wait, what happened? I just feel like I'm missing important story beats. So it was kind of disappointing. You know, like I finally got to the place, you know, almost the next to last issue of Bendis's run. And I finally get to a place where, okay, yeah, Bendis, you finally got me. I want to read the next issue. And then this comes out and this is how you wrap everything up. Yeah. Really subpar. Superman is extremely minor character in this issue. And he kind of has been for a lot of this House of L storyline. And I don't really care for the dynamics between the, you know, different members of the House of L. And, you know, I should. Like, I want to like Superman's relationship with, and I keep saying House of L, House of Kent. But I want to enjoy Superman's relationship with his son, right? Like, Clark and John had a great relationship in the Tomasi Gleason run of Superman. And there's no chemistry between those characters here. You know, Connor Kent is a beloved character. Fans love him. And here I don't know, maybe there's not enough real estate on the page. Nobody really gets a chance to shine. Brainiac 5, I guess, gets a few good lines. I mean, Lois has a few good lines, but you know, when we're talking about the House of Kent in terms of these five heroes that have, you know, banded together to stop the invisible mafia, we're talking about Supergirl, Connor Kent, Superboy, John Kent, Superboy, and Brainiac 5, and Superman himself. It's too many characters, I guess. There's not enough. Bendis is trying to stick too much in, and maybe that's where the choppiness comes from. So ultimately, I was disappointed. After finally being engaged in Action Comics, ultimately, I was disappointed when they finally defeat Red Cloud. It feels extremely choppy, like it jumps from one page to the other without, I'm like, wait, what happened here? Like, cause you don't even really see what happens. And then all of a sudden they're someplace else. And I'm like, wait, what? That doesn't make any sense. What happened? And it's just really anticlimactic. So bottom line is, this is not the time to be jumping on Superman. Wait till Bendis is off Action Comics and then jump on. I guess Bendis fans are enjoying it. I don't know. I don't really feel like I know that many Bendis fans anymore. Ultimately his Action Comics run for me is a total failure. It's just not good. You know, I had problems with Invisible Mafia right from the start. The fact that they thought they could operate under Superman's nose in Metropolis never made sense to me. The Leviathan Rising stuff really disjointed and flat. So yeah, I can't believe he's been on Superman, I think, for 3 years now, and it never got good. And, you know, I didn't like it from the beginning, and I kept saying, well, let's give it a chance. Let's see who Superman is to him. I don't know that I ever got an answer, and it's kind of disappointing. So anyway, enough about Action Comics. It wasn't good. Skip it. You know, and I know people give me a bad time. Well, why are you still reading it? Man, it's Action Comics, right? Like, I don't have a complete run, obviously, because the early issues were uber expensive. But, you know, I've got issues that go all the way back to the 200s. And from, I think, around 400 up through 1,000, I've got them all. So it's, yeah. I mean, it's totally valid that I shouldn't be reading it, you know? I should be voting with my dollars and saying, hey, this isn't good. But I just, it's that collector mentality. Superman's my favorite character. It's a book I'm always gonna pick up. So anyway, let me move on to the next book. I guess alphabetical order here, I didn't realize. But it's The Amazing Spider-Man 53LR, which is The Last Remains. So this is kind of the companion series to the normal series that's going on right now, that's talking about this Last Remains storyline, that has kind of the Spider-Man family with Miles and Spider-Gwen and Jessica Drew and the old Spider-Woman who's now Madame Web. Can't think of her name right now. That's going to drive me crazy. But anyway, does it say, it might even say here, actually. Now, Order of the Web is what they're calling themselves. But anyway, it's written by Nick Spencer and Matthew Rosenberg. We have art by Federico Vincentini and Takeshi Miyazawa. And then where's, inks are by those two with Scott Hanna. And then we have Marcio Menez and Eric Arseneguia as colorist, and letters are by Ariana Maurer. Man, this issue has a lot of people whose names are very hard to pronounce. That's definitely the case. Anyway, we saw Moreland show up in the last issue with the Sin Eater hunting him. So there's not a whole lot that happens in this issue. And Julia Carpenter, that's her name. Julia Carpenter, who was the second Spider-Woman and is now Madame Web. I knew it would come to me. Anyway, this issue, we basically get a fight between Sin Eater and Moreland. And I won't tell you how that turns out. You have to read it for yourself. And then the other half of the issue is that Order of the Web, Miles Morales. I think it's Spider-Girl. She used to be Aranya, who I think is getting, or she used to be, maybe she's Silk now. I can't keep it straight. Anyway, Madam Web. Yeah, I think she is Silk. And then, as I said, the new Spider-Woman, who used to be Aranya, and then Madam Web, who used to be Spider-Woman, Julia Carpenter, and then the original Spider-Woman, Jessica Drew, and Miles Morales. That's Order of the Web. They had traveled to some extra dimension with Doctor Strange to try to find what happened to Peter. All right, so this companion series to what's going on in the regular Amazing Spider-Man series is all about what's going on with the Order of the Web, where over in the main story, Nick Spencer needs all the pages to focus just on Peter. So that's basically the two plot lines that are going on here. You've got Sin Eater versus Morlun, and then you've got the Order of the Web trying to track down Peter, who we saw two issues ago get sucked into the afterlife. Like, supposedly he's been killed and he's there in the afterlife with Kindred. And then if you read last week, spoilers if you didn't, I didn't talk about it last week or last time an Amazing Spider-Man issue came out. I think it was last week. I did mention that only one thing happened. And it was kind of a weird issue. It's almost like, wait, so you say you don't have enough room in Amazing Spider-Man, but yet when you have a whole issue that takes less than 5 minutes to read because there's hardly any dialogue and literally only one thing happens. And the only thing that happened in issue 53 is Kindred revealed himself to be Norman Osborn, which we already knew as readers, but he revealed himself to Peter as Norman Osborn. That's literally the only thing that happened. It was like, took 5 minutes to read the issue. It's kind of a disappointment for $4 or $5 or whatever it was. So anyway, not really buying the idea that if that's how you're going to construct an issue, that there's not enough room to put the Order of the Web storyline in there as well. So, but that's only been one issue, and I have been enjoying Matthew Rosenberg and Nick Spencer have been doing here, and the Order of the Web, the interactions between the characters, I'm enjoying. It certainly shows how much they all kind of are inspired by Peter Parker and his work as Spider-Man. You don't normally think of Spider-Man as a super and, you know, inspiring character. You think more Captain America on the Marvel side of things and probably Superman on the DC side of things. But Spider-Man has really, with that whole line that's been quoted 1,000 times, you know, with great power comes great responsibility, Spider-Man has really influenced a lot of newer generation heroes. When you talk about, you know, heroes that have debuted in the last, I don't know, 20 or 30 years at Marvel. So it's great to see kind of the fruits of that borne out here on the comic page. So 53.lr, I thought it was decent, better than the regular 53 episode art issue that was super short. The art is okay. It's not the cleanest art. So it's not my favorite, but the storytelling is good. I think the color work is really spectacular. And I think the layouts within the panels are done really well also. And it ends with a little bit of a cliffhanger. So I'm definitely looking forward to reading 54.lr when it comes out. All right. Let's see. What do we have up next? Looks like it is the Batman White Knight Presents Harley Quinn number 2. This is Sean Murphy and Katana Collins on story, Katana Collins on script, Matteo Scalera on the art, Dave Stewart handles the colors, and World Designs does the letters. So kind of like the other Black Label Harley book that I've been reading, the Joker Harley Quinn Criminal Sanity, this is a different version of Harley Quinn. You know, this is Sean Gordon Murphy's Batman White Knight universe, if you will. And it's not the same Gotham, you know, that you're going to see in the regular continuity. Bruce Wayne's in jail. Joker apparently is dead. Harley kind of lives in the gray area, sort of like she does in the regular DCU right now, but she's a little more on the side of angels than she is in the regular DCU. And she's even been contracted here. She's been deputized by the Gotham authorities. I don't think they're called the Gotham Police Department in this reality. But anyway, she's working for the Gotham law enforcement to try to find some serial killer that's been obviously killing people. And she thinks she knows how they're and who they're inspired by. And again, much like Criminal Sanity, it's leaning on her her skills, not as an acrobat or some crazy former sidekick of the Joker or girlfriend or whatever, but more on the cerebral nature, on her expertise as a psychiatrist and a psychologist, criminal profiler. And, you know, she's kind of drawing on the experiences from the Joker to try to track down this the serial killer. So just like that Joker Harley Criminal Sanity book, when you start taking the zaniness away from Harley, that's when I like her best. I'm sure there's plenty of people out there who don't. They love the nostalgia of it, a callback to the Batman the Animated Series cartoon where she's talking with the, you know, Brooklyn accent and she's zany and crazy and whatever. And that's not for me. I just don't like that version of Harley. This is the version of Harley I like. I feel like she has a lot more substance. I feel like she's more relatable. I can understand where she's coming from. And it's interesting, you know, I've always been kind of a fan of true crime and you know, solving things with forensics and criminal profiling and things like that. So it's sort of right up my alley. I understand it's not for everybody, but I do enjoy this version of Harley more than the crazy zany one. And it's different enough. Like this is much less grounded in reality than Criminal Sanity. This is probably maybe halfway between what you see in the regular DC universe in Harley and the Harley that you see in Criminal Sanity from Cami Garcia. That one's really grounded in reality. It's supposed to come across as very realistic. This is a little more traditional superhero, you know, but it's not so far down the line that it just seems, you know, absolutely crazy. But it's solid. And I like the voice that Katana Collins is giving Harley in this book. She understands that she's made mistakes. She does have a little bit of, I don't want to say mental illness, but she knows that she's made mistakes and her past is kind of follows her around to some extent. She has baggage. She has been damaged because of her relationship with the Joker. And she owns all that. She doesn't necessarily make excuses. She just kind of realizes, hey, this is the place I'm in right now. It's not the best place. You know, having to raise two kids that are literally the Joker's kids as a single mom and not being able to necessarily relate to those kids. We saw that. She kind of talked about that in the first issue. And so there are realistic and relatable touch points to the character. You can understand why she would be struggling with these kind of things, having had that relationship with Jack Napier, you know, when he wasn't a Joker and he was trying to live the straight and narrow. So again, I think it's expertly done. You add into that tone and characterization of Harley this little bit of a crime noir mystery story that's been going on. We don't know too much about the main character here. She apparently is killing old time movie stars, and we're not sure exactly what her deal is yet, what her motivations are. So I'm sure we're gonna learn a lot more about that in the next issue. Harley's dubbed her the Starlet, and is assuming that this killer, the Starlet, is working for somebody called the Producer. So again, it all goes back to the kind of old Hollywood, LA confidential crime noir feel of the story, being that these actors are being killed. And on the last page, we do finally get a look at Starlet, which really cool. I mean, she looks like she's all black and white herself. Like she just stepped out of a black and white movie, and that panel is almost all black and white. So it's done really, really well by Dave Stewart, who, no surprise, he's a really great colorist. As far as the art goes, you know, Sean Gordon Murphy did most of the art in the Batman White Knight universe up to this point. But I think Matteo Scalera does an excellent job of giving that same style. Like, it feels very consistent. I mean, his art isn't exactly like Sean Gordon Murphy. It's a little less angular than Murphy's is, especially in the way he draws action. Scalera's is it's just a little bit softer, a little more cartoony, if you will, but it's close enough. Like, if I think to an untrained eye, people might not even realize it's somebody different. So the art is done really, really well. So this is a quality book that I think I haven't heard too many people talking about it, and I think I said that about the first issue, but it's definitely worth your time, especially if you want kind of a different take on Harley Quinn. All right, up next, it's our latest death metal, Dark Knight's death metal one-shot. It's called The Multiverse Who Laughs. Got a ton of creators because there's a ton of different stories. Scott Snyder, James Tynan, Joshua Williamson, Oswalt, Palmiotti, Connor, Thomas, Ahmed, Gedeon, Green, Harden, Tom Mandrake, Eaton, Ratman, Spicer, Baron, Angiolini, S. Mandrake, and Hi-Fi. So there's a bunch of different colors here, bunch of different creators, and it's basically the Robin King is telling scary stories to his groblins. So, you know, he starts off by telling them that they've heard all the stories about, you know, Batman and Wonder Woman and Superman and you know, all the big stories, but there's a lot of other smaller stories going on that don't necessarily have endings or don't necessarily seem that impactful, but he wants them to know, like, their story's worth telling. So that story of the Robin King explaining this to the groblins, that's sort of the framework that the rest of the stories fit into. And that one is written by Scott Snyder, James Tynan, Joshua Williamson, art by Juan Gedeon, Mike Spicer on colors, and Troy Pateri on letters. And then we get into the actual stories he tells that are then written by the other creators. So we have one that starts as Zaz, and that's the one by Oswalt, Patton Oswalt, who many people may know as a comedian. Sanford Green on art, David Barron on colors, Josh Reed on letters. That one's okay. I'm not a big Zaz fan, but it was kind of cool. It had a fun twist. Probably my favorite one is the next one. It's Super Pets. Amanda Connor, Jimmy Palmiotti writing, Chan Harden doing the art. So that's that old classic Harley Quinn team reunited there. And then we have Enrica, Aaron, Angiolini on colors, and Carlos Mangal doing the letters. And the only thing I'll say about that, it has a little bit of a twist too. And even though it's Super Pets, that it's not one you're going to want to read your kids for a bedtime story. It's dark. It is very dark, but it's really fun. And I'm sure Jimmy and Amanda and Chad had a lot of fun creating that one. Next up, this one was really short, but I liked it. I don't know that I've seen any other work that Saladin Ahmed has done for DC, but he's the writer on this one. So it's Green Arrow, Green Lantern in hard travel, you know, the classic hard traveling heroes. Scott Eaton on pencils, Norm Ratman on inks, Hi-Fi colors, and Troy Pateri on letters. And that one was enjoyable, but again, the thing about it, and it, this goes for a lot of these stories, it just seems like there could be so much more. I don't know if editorial purposely told everybody, hey, leave it open-ended, but it feels a little open-ended, especially the Green Arrow, Green Lantern. Like, when it was over, I was like, wait, that's only like 4 pages? And the way it ended, it wasn't a cliffhanger, but it just, I was like, okay, what happens next? So yeah, it was kind of interesting. So I'm not sure why they decided to to go that direction and leave some of these stories feeling not incomplete. I want to say they feel incomplete, but it just feels like there's more there to mine. There's more material. There's more mileage you could get out of the concept. Last one is Steel and the Fear Index. That one's written by Brandon Thomas. Art by Thomas Mandrake. Colors by Cian Mandrake. And letters by Darren Bennett. That was probably... well, I guess not my least favorite. I think the Zaz one was my least favorite. But that one really... Brandon Thomas did a great job of giving a cool voice to Steel. Like, you really see him in a different way, or at least I do. I mean, obviously I've read Steel being a Superman fan, but he's never somebody that I feel like I really got a good handle on. And I feel like if you don't have any idea who John Henry Irons is or Steel, this is a good introductory to what makes him tick. I didn't care much for the art. Tom Mandrake's art style just didn't really do much for me. I feel like he's one of those that kind of needs an inker, I think. I don't know. It didn't feel messy, but it just didn't. It felt a little sketchy. The line work wasn't. I don't know. It felt a little sloppy to me. So, anyway, if you're reading the death metal story, the you can totally skip this. This is not one of the one shots that I would say is crucial. It doesn't really add much to the story, but some of these are fun. And like I said, the Super Pets one by Jimmy and Amanda and Chad was a blast. But being that there's only four stories and then none of them really impact death metal, you can definitely skip it if you're looking to save some dollars or you're just not sure if it's important or not. Okay, up next I have a Marvel book. It's Daredevil number 24, written by Chip Zdarsky. Pencils are by Mike Hawthorne. Inks by J.P. Meyer. Colors by Mattia Iacono. And letters by Clayton Cowles. So it's Truth or Dare Part 4. We've got the trial of Daredevil about to start. Matt Murdock is putting himself on trial for having killed somebody. He thinks he deserves to be punished. He has that strong sense of right and wrong. So for me, the best thing about the Daredevil book from Zdarsky is the emotional weight he puts behind the stories. And I've said before how it's not like he's doing something completely new and original, like Daredevil going to jail has been done, right? But Zdarsky, because of the emotional weight, and Daredevil has often been an emotional book, and you know, Matt's been through a lot, and he's lost a lot of girlfriends. His brother Mike Murdock even mentions in this one's like, man, you know, you're like, you don't want to be your girlfriend. You're gonna end up dead. So he's had more than his fair share of tragedy. So for that reason, the Daredevil book at times has been very emotional. Very emotional. It's been a very heavy read, a very depressing book in a way. But Zdarsky, even though he's not treading, you know, brand new ground here, he still has a fresh take on it. He brings in kind of insight into Matt's thinking. So it's one thing to have him feel a certain way, and we can all understand why he might be devastated if, you know, Elektra dies or Karen Page dies or whoever it might be. You know, him losing his relationship with what's her name, Kristen McDuffie. We can understand that, like we can relate to that. But what Zdarsky does is he not only gives us that emotional impact so that we can relate to what Matt is feeling, we can understand, he gives us insight into why Matt is feeling that way. So it's a little richer. It's a little more fleshed out. And you know, I wasn't sure what to expect. I was a huge fan of the Charles Soule run, so I wasn't sure what to expect with Zdarsky coming on. And I say all that to say this. This has probably been my least favorite issue of the Czarski run so far. And that's not to say that it's a bad issue at all. It just feels like it's a transitional issue. It's Czarski sort of tying up the threads of the plot that he needs to tie up so the next issue can hit really hard. And when we get the next issue preview, I'm assuming it's the cover, man, it's a really great image. I'm not going to describe it at all because it's a little spoilery, but it's absolutely amazing. So I wouldn't go so far as to say there's a twist in this episode because, or this issue, you really do see it coming. It's more of a curveball for Matt's legal team than for us as the readers. But everything gets wrapped up that needs to get wrapped up here so that we can get to the next stage of the story that Czarski wants to tell of Daredevil. So again, it's not my favorite issue, but it's necessary. And it does wrap up a lot of what Czarski's been doing. There's still emotion there, and there's definitely insight into Matt's thinking. You can completely understand why he's doing what he's doing. So all in all, a decent issue, but like I said, not my favorite. The art's really strong from Mike Hawthorne. I particularly liked, I think it's right on the first page. Yeah, the first page where... Foggy and Matt are on the roof of their building and they're talking about some of the things that Foggy has done to try to win Matt's case and things that need to be done. And in the background, there's graffiti like sprayed on the walls, and the graffiti are some of like the legendary Daredevil creators from the past. You see Maz back there, you know, for Mazzucchelli. You see Frank, obviously Frank Miller. You see Klaus for Klaus Janson. You see Somni. You see Bill for Bill Sienkiewicz. So I love that. I love that Hawthorne is throwing those in there as kind of an homage, if you will, to some of the legendary Daredevil creators of the past. I really enjoyed that. So yeah, all in all, the art is solid. And man, when you get to that preview of the cover for the next issue, yeah, it really makes me want to read the next issue. I'm very excited. As I said, it's not new ground that Czarski is treading, but he's putting a new enough twist on the story that he's telling that it feels fresh. And if you've never read Daredevil, I definitely think that Czarski's run is new reader friendly. I think you could pick it up with issue one and hit the ground running. All right. Up next, I have Department of Truth, number 3, from writer James Tynan IV. Art is by Martin Simons. Letters by Aditya Bidikar. Designed by Dylan Todd. This is a really disturbing issue. So I think it's far enough along here. As I said, this is the third issue of Department of Truth that I can, without too much fear of spoiling, talk about the premise of the series. So the whole idea is there's this secret clandestine department in the U.S. government called the Department of Truth. And their job is to go around and kind of debunk conspiracies, kind of like in the background, because apparently what happens in the real world is if enough people start to believe a conspiracy, it starts to physically manifest and become true. And in order to keep reality functioning and, you know, heading in a linear time forward, this department has to go out there and do whatever they can to kind of nip these conspiracy theories in the bud, so to speak. So if enough people, for example, are believing that the world is flat, the world literally becomes flat. And, you know, ocean liners and shipping cargo ships or what have you, they're going to sail over the edge and fall into the abyss. So this Department of Truth has to go out there and use whatever means necessary to debunk these conspiracy theories and make sure that people aren't buying into them so they don't become real. And this issue is disturbing, not because the ideas are wild and crazy, because they are, but because it's pulled so much from our reality. And it's heartbreaking, the story that unfolds here, the narrative that Tynan is giving us, because we all know that's not really what happens, right? Like 7 million people tomorrow could believe the earth is flat and the earth's not going to become flat. But it's sad to think that there are people out there who are buying into this stuff, that the truth has become subjective, that people aren't smart enough to see through the self-serving lies that people are saying. And so, it's inherently political in that 99% of the time when you hear these crazy theories, they're coming from conservatives. And I don't know why that is. I don't know why the right, the conservative, alt-right, whatever you want to call it, I don't know why they feel more disenfranchised now, because culture in this country seems to be getting more progressive. So maybe it's fear. Maybe it's them wanting to believe they belong to something special. I don't know. I don't know what the answer is. But it's sad, and it's disturbing, because it's true. You see it right now in this country when you talk about who won the election, and with absolutely zero evidence, you have a president saying, "Hey, there's fraud. There's this widespread fraud," and even his lawyers and legal team are saying, "Hey, there's widespread fraud." But then when they go to the actual court, because it's one thing to hold a press conference, you can say whatever you want. Right? You're not going to get in trouble. You can say freedom of speech, whatever, say whatever. But if you go into a courtroom and you say, "Hey, there's widespread fraud," and accuse people and you have no proof, well, that's against the law. You can get thrown in jail. You can be fined, thousands of dollars. And so right there, it shows the dichotomy, right? And so you can say what you want, but when push comes to shove, there is no proof. And so when you read this story and you see that some of what Tynan is saying here and some of what he's pulling is from reality, and it actually happened, there's events that actually happened, tragic events that other people are making light of, that just bothers me. It just bothers me that there's people out there that are buying into these fantasies. And you can't even talk to some of them sometimes, no matter what you say, or it used to be you could turn on the evening news, Walter Cronkite, Peter Jennings, Dan Rather, Ted Koppel, Tom Brokaw, these people were trusted. These guys were trusted newsmen, and you knew if you saw something on there, it was true. And now, and I get it, like, there's bias in I'm not saying there's not bias in the media. Obviously there is, Fox News leans right, CNN leans left, and all that kind of stuff. And so they're providing you news, and it does have some political slant to it, and it shouldn't. The news should just be the facts, and they shouldn't be subjective. But now, even if you're out there saying, CNN comes out and says, "Hey, grass is green," and we can all see grass is green, but you're going to have a sudden, segment of the population that says, "No, that's fake news. If they're saying it, it can't be true." And all of a sudden it hasn't become about what is right or wrong, what is true or false. It's just become about winning, right? Like, my side has to win. That's what matters. And even more than my side winning matters, I need the other side to lose. And I don't know where that comes from. I don't know why that's the divisive state that we've found ourselves in. But when you read Department of Truth number 3, it's not scary because of some big monster or some tension that Tynan builds, or some gory art from Martin Simons, or some scary art from Martin Simons. The reason it's scary is because it's not that far from the reality that we're living in. And when you read the book, you read this issue, you can't help but feel the kind of the despair and the depression and the struggle and the pain of the people that are closest to this tragic situation that happened, and how their pain is prolonged through these false narratives and these false conspiracies, and to see them get sucked into that. And it's just disturbing because it's so close to reality. So for me, it was a very uncomfortable issue to read. And so if you're coming at your fiction or your story or your art, whatever you want to call it, from a standpoint of you want it to evoke an emotional response, you want it to engage the reader, make them think, then you got to consider this a home run in my book from the entire creative team, because it does all that. You know, I was reading it and I was shaking my head, and it's just very poignant and very sad and very relevant. And then we're getting a lot of that in comics these days. And there's part of me that thinks, hey, great. And there's part of me that's also like exhausted at this point from pandemic and politics and being isolated at home, saying, man, I just want an escape. But art is going to imitate life. It always does. And speaking of art, the art in this book, I've talked about it before, Martin Simons, it's not my favorite style of comic book art. You know, it's watercolor painting, so you don't get clean lines. It's impressionistic at times, but there's a lot of cool symbolism, and it definitely suits the narrative. And Martin Simons is a good choice for this sort of dark psychological tale that Tynan is reading. So I think the best issue so far of the run in terms of just impact. First one is probably my favorite in terms of the cool little twist at the end. That's one thing I'm still not going to spoil, even three issues in, who the head of the Department of Truth is. You find that out in like the last page of the first issue. It's so cool. And I can't wait to learn more about that character and how they ended up leading the Department of Truth. But in terms of impact, I got to say that Department of Truth number 3 is the most impactful issue of the series so far. So great job by the entire creative team there. All right, up next we have Detective Comics 1031, Smash the Mirror. It's from a writer, Peter J. Tomasi. We have Bilquist Evely on art, Matt Lopez handling the colors, and Rob Lee on letters. We find out who is behind the mirror. We got introduced to that character a few issues ago, and this one we find out who it is, and that is all I'm going to say. I'm not going to say whether it's a character we've seen before, whether it's a brand new character, but you do get the answers to who it is here. So again, like I've talked about in the past on Detective, topical and kind of going in line with what's going on in Batman after the fallout of Joker War with the whole anti-vigilante thing. That's Mirror's whole shtick. Anybody who wears a mask is bad, even though Mirror himself is wearing a mask. It's like, I only wear it to reflect whoever's looking at me. That's his way of saying I'm one of you, I suppose. We have Batman trying to appeal to the better angels of the citizens of Gotham directly. And we have Damian continuing his investigation into apparent assassination attempts on his dad's life, on Bruce Wayne's life when he was a child. So solid issue. I think I mentioned before, I don't know that Bilquist Evely is my favorite Batman artist. I think that she's an incredible artist, and I love her on things like Justice League Dark or over in the Sandman universe corner of DC. But for traditional superhero stuff, I'm not sold. But I will say I feel like her style is a little cleaner on this issue than it was on the last issue that she did. Maybe it's because this one doesn't have a dream sequence like that last one did. So I did like her art better on this issue than the previous issue. Kind of like the Daredevil issue, though. I feel like this is somewhat of a transition issue. There's not a lot of big high story beats, not a lot of super important story beats other than the reveal of who the mirror is, but it's necessary. I think this is set up for the next issue where I think we'll get the climax to this whole mirror situation. So solid issue. Peter J. Tomasi is doing a great job on Detective as he has all along. I don't want to say I do find it disappointing, but one of the things I loved about Tomasi's run for a long time when he first started was how instantly classic and timeless it felt, because you feel like it wasn't beholden to anything else that was going on in the DC universe. Like, it was just kind of off on its own, and you could read those stories and insert them anywhere in the DC timeline and it would work. It's great that they're a little more tied in to the other Bat book now with the whole fallout from Joker War, but it doesn't have that timeless feel. So I do miss that a little bit, but that's a minor nitpick. It's still enjoyable. I still like the characters and the storytelling, and I'm really excited to see Brad Walker come back on art. I think he's coming back next issue, or maybe the following issue. He's become one of my favorite Batman artists. He's just so dynamic. He's been putting up pages on Twitter lately that have been blowing me away. So Detective continues to be really, really good. So great job. And yeah, that's all I'm going to say. I want to talk about a little bit more about the mirror, but I can't say anything without possibly giving stuff away, and I don't want to do that. So I will just move on. All right, up next, let's talk a little Dr. Doom. It's issue number 9 from writer Christopher Cantwell. Art is by Salvador Alaroca, colors by Guru EFX, and letters by Corey Petit. I tweeted out earlier on Tuesday, I'm recording this late Tuesday night, about one of the lines that Doom says in the book, which made me laugh out loud. It was so funny. Somebody's like, hey, how about you don't give us lines from a book that doesn't even come out until tomorrow? You know, we don't want to spoil. You're ruining it. I really don't like to give spoilers. You guys know, I try not to give any spoilers, but the line were just so good. And I was just in a mood and I thought it was funny. I wanted to put it out there. And I also wanted to remind everybody that Dr. Doom has been canceled. I think it's ending with issue 10, the next issue. So there is a change.org, I think it is, petition that's going around to save Dr. Doom, to keep it going. And we need to get many people to digitally sign that as possible to show Marvel that Christopher Cantwell is making Doom more relevant and more relatable and more human than he has ever been. I've never been a fan of Doom. He's always felt like a very mustache twirling villain to me. And I absolutely love this series. I love what Cantwell has been doing with him. So I'm tweeting out that link to that petition a couple times a day over the next few weeks. So if you see it, it literally takes like 30 seconds to click on the link and then click on sign this petition. So you click on the link, you go to the site, click sign this petition, you put in your name and your email, and that's it, you're done. And you don't even have to put in a real email, you can put in a fake email if you want. But yeah, I really would like to see Cantwell get to do another arc of Doom. So, and I won't repeat the line that I thought was hilarious, because I guess I shouldn't have mentioned it, because it technically it is spoiling, and I want you guys to read it. But I will say it's on page, let's see, 1, 2, 3. It's on page 4. The last two dialogue boxes on page 4. Absolutely hilarious. So Salvador LaRocca's art on the book has also been spectacular. This is just a great book. I can't really talk too much about what goes on in the story here, because it's a very tightly written issue. Like, it's all right there. It's all the one plot. Doom trying to basically complete the job that what's his name? Blue, whatever, trying to stop the black hole. And I can't remember, what was that hero's name? I'm trying to think about it. Blue Marvel, that's it. How can I, it's a Marvel book and I can't remember Blue Marvel. But yeah, Blue Marvel tried to seal the black hole. Last issue was unsuccessful. So now it's Doom's turn to take a crack and seal the black hole that's near the moon and save the Earth. And everything that Doom has planned after that, all his machinations you see all kind of build upon him having that street cred or that hero act in his back pocket to show that he's redeemed. So things don't go necessarily the way you might think. And the reasons for that are, again, pitch perfect for Doom. And this is just master class in understanding a character and bringing depth to a character that's been around a long time. And I know that other people have done Doom very well. I think a lot of people talk about John Byrne and some of the issues that he's done and him fleshing out and adding to Doom as a character. I haven't read all those issues, so it's hard for me to say. A lot of the Doom stuff I've read, he's always felt very two-dimensional to me, but it's clear that Christopher Cantwell has an affinity for the character, and I just want more. I think this is a classic story, and I think giving Christopher a few more issues, we could end up with something even more special. So highly, highly recommend this issue. Even if you haven't been reading Dr. Doom at all up until this point, you can pick up issue 9, no problem. You've got the little blurb inside the front cover, tells you everything you need to know. And when you read the issue, Doom himself tells you everything you need to know about where he's at and who he is as a character and who he is to the writer, Christopher Cantwell, and who Doom is to us and how Doom sees everybody else. Again, it's just masterfully done. It's perfect. I absolutely love this issue. Favorite issue of the series so far. And those two lines are two dialogue boxes with the line that I tweeted out. Like I said, had me laughing out loud. Really, really well done. So kudos to the entire creative team for a perfect issue of Dr. Doom. All right. Speaking of the Fantastic Four, next up, we have Fantastic Four Antithesis, issue number 4. This is the final issue of the miniseries from storytellers Mark Waid and Neil Adams. Inks are by Mark Farmer, colors by Laura Martin, and letters by Joe Caramagna. We had an amazing end to issue 3. Spoilers for that if you hadn't read it from last month. But we saw that Antithesis, which was this malevolent, super powerful entity that was basically out-galacticing Galactus and had banished Galactus to the negative zone. We saw he was actually defeated in issue 3, and the Fantastic Four were able to get Galactus back his powers, but the trick, and the cliffhanger, the twist at the ending of issue 3 is as the power is coming back across space to Galactus's ship, instead of going into Galen, which is Galactus in his human, normal human-sized, non-powered form, instead of the power that makes Galactus Galactus, instead of it going back into Galen, it goes back into Reed Richards. And we find out that Reed has his reasons for literally stealing the power of Galactus. And so this issue is about why Reed does what he did and what the Fantastic Four do, the rest of the Fantastic Four and the Silver Surfer. So basically Thing, Human Torch, Invisible Woman, and Silver Surfer, what they do to try to save Reed or try to change Reed's mind. So I thought this was actually ended up being a really good series. The first issue was
just messy, I thought. I didn't think it was paced well. It felt like a kind of a lot of wasted pages until you got to sort of the end. Issue two was a lot of action. Issue three with that twist was even better. And issue four is a great payoff. So it's one of those series that definitely builds. First issue is kind of the weakest. And also I talked about the Neil Adams art. I still think his style is a little dated, but he does have still those instinctive storytelling instincts. And so, you know, layouts and the line work and everything, it definitely works. The other thing that works really well is the narrative that Wade and Adams are telling. It feels very authentically Fantastic Four, like the way that they go about saving the day. You know, this whole story has been a cosmic adventure and, you know, cosmic pulp adventure, if you will, which is exactly what the Fantastic Four is. But it's also rooted in things like family and heart and, you know, loyalty to teammates. And it really goes to show that that idea of family and connection, it's what makes the Fantastic Four Marvel's first family. And it still boggles my mind that at some point Marvel wasn't producing Fantastic Four comics, but that's a topic for a whole nother podcast. But this ended up being a very prototype, a story that really epitomizes who the Fantastic Four are. So in that way, it's sort of strange that it's called Fantastic Four Antithesis. You know, antithesis meaning the exact opposite of something. And again, that being the villain, the supposed villain of the piece, who stole Galactus's powers. Because when you think about it, it's really the opposite. The story is exactly who the Fantastic Four are. It's not the antithesis of who the Fantastic Four are. It really, the story, the art, the sense of cosmic adventure, it all really, really brings into sharp focus who the Fantastic Four are. So again, great standalone. Somebody who's never read the Fantastic Four, you could give this to them. And I think they would enjoy it. I think ends up being a really, really well done story. And I really did enjoy it. All right, let's move on to the next title. It's Maestro number four. This is the penultimate issue. It's going to end next issue with number five. We have Peter David writing. Herman Peralta is the artist. Jesus Arbatov is the color artist. Letters by Ariana Marr. And I don't want to say I'm disappointed, because I am enjoying the Maestro series. But sort of the opposite of Fantastic Four Antithesis, where the first issue was the weakest there. The first issue here was the one that showed the most promise to me. I was really hoping we were going to get an exploration of the thinking process and the psychology of the Hulk or Bruce Banner going from hero, waking up in this sort of dystopian world and trying to survive. And we were going to get insight into the choices he was forced into that ultimately led to him becoming Maestro. I feel like we're seeing the actions he's taking that are leading him to that path, but I missed where the switch got flipped. And maybe it's just me. Maybe I need to go back and reread it. Maybe it wasn't any big thing. Maybe it was more to do with Banner's, you know, different personality aspects, that he was just in this, you know, dystopian world and he did what he had to do to survive. And that meant becoming more ruthless. But I can't help but feel like it was a little bit of a missed opportunity just because of the promise and what I felt like we were going to get based on the first issue. So it's enjoyable. It's entertaining. It's just not as deep as I wanted it to be. So this particular issue is all about the Hulk Hercules battle, which is epic and fun and awesome. And at the end of the day, we see Bruce take another big step toward becoming Maestro. So I could definitely see how it all wraps up next issue. And I can't really say much more than that about it because, again, I don't want to spoil. But the other thing about it was, you know, and I've said this before when talking about this series, huge fan of Dale Keown's art on the Hulk from the 90s. And I felt like the first issue, Herman Peralta was homaging that in the kind of the tone of his artwork. But ever since then, it's been a little softer. And I'm not sure how else to describe it beyond that. But Keown art is always, you know, very solid lines, very grounded. And even the way it's colored, and it doesn't have that softness to it that this art has. So I'm not sure what the change in style was for or why it changed. It's still really great art. And especially we'll call out the fight with Hercules and the Hulk. Absolutely wonderful transitions from panel to panel, like really perfect example of sequential storytelling, that entire fight. So overall, the art is very, very good. And, I would never say, okay, how can we make your art look more like this other person's art? Because obviously, Herman Peralta is going to, you know, draw the way he draws. And that's great. I don't know why it just, the art seems a little bit different. Like enough to be noticeable in that first issue compared to subsequent issues. So if you didn't hear, there is this Maestro series has been so popular and so successful that they're giving Mark Waid, Peter David rather, another series called Maestro Pax, I think, which means peace. So that one starts up in January. So we get the final issue of Maestro in December, and then we don't even have to skip a month. We already have another Maestro series coming. So I look forward to that. All right, up next we have Red Hood number 51. And what's interesting about this, so I thought Red Hood was actually coming to an end with 50, but that was Red Hood Outlaw that was coming to an end. And now we have a new creative team and it's just called Red Hood. So I'm not, like, usually when you do this, you start over with a number one. But for whatever reason, DC is keeping the same numbering. So the other thing to note about this Red Hood series is it's written by Sean Martinborough, who most people who are familiar with that name are going to know it from his work on Detective Comics as a penciler or his work on Robert Kirkman's Thief of Thieves. I think he drew every issue of that series. But here he is. He's just writing. We have pencils by Tony Akins, inks by Stefano Guadiano, colors by Paul Mounts, and letters by Troy Pateri. We've got Red Hood coming back to Gotham and settling down in sort of not the best neighborhood in Gotham, I'll say. Almost like a little bit of a Catwoman vibe. And he starts making friends and making contacts and reintroducing himself to people he's known in the past. Meanwhile, the majority of the issue is all about the supporting characters, the crime families, the gangs, the other players in this area of Gotham. So it feels very urban. It feels very street, which definitely suits Red Hood and definitely suits Jason Todd. Like I said, Martin Burroughs worked on Detective Comics and then Thief of Thieves most recently. And those are very gritty, down-to-earth, urban titles, at least the way Detective was written back then was, and Thief of Thieves certainly was that. So is this going to be sort of crime noirish? I don't know. It may be even a little too urban and a little too street for me, but I'm definitely giving it at least one more issue. I don't know if Sean has written anything before. So I think it's paced pretty well. If this is the first thing he's done, I'm sure he's getting some help from DC editorial. That's always a challenge, pacing when you're a new writer. but I'm just not sure if this is the take on Red Hood that I want to read. So I was really hoping Manny was going to join me for this episode. He was supposed to, but I couldn't get a hold of him because he's been a big fan of Red Hood since it started in Rebirth. And so I was very curious to see how he felt about this new direction because the tone is completely different. So I guess we'll have to ask him about that last time. But give it a try if you're a fan of something that's urban and street. Definitely kind of suits the direction the Batman title's going in now with Bruce not having his resources or Alfred there to help him out. So kind of the same thing there with Red Hood. All right, up next, Scumbag number 2 from writer Rick Remender, art by Andrew Robinson, colors by Marino D'Anesio, and letters by Russ Wooten. I don't think I talked about Scumbag number 1. Here we are with Scumbag number 2, and I will say that this comic is just disgusting. It's not for the faint of heart. It's definitely for mature readers. The main character, Scumbag, as it were, Uri is his name. He definitely is a very reprehensible human being. He's gross. He's uncouth. He's disgusting. He's a super drug abuser, like no redeeming qualities whatsoever. You know, the tagline for the series, the world's fate rests with the worst person on it. That is the most appropriate tagline for a comic ever, based on who Ernie is. And kind of like some of the other books I've talked about, I mean, this is like really over the top, just Remender pushing things, you know, way over the line and going for the gross out sort of thing. And so you don't take anything in this book too seriously, but just like a lot of other books I've been talking about lately, this one does get really political here in the second issue with who the bad guys appear to be. And again, you kind of take it with a grain of salt, but at the same time, I just feel like, man, here's another book that's really pulling from real life, you know, with these kind of intolerant groups, you know. You know, I just got finished talking about how Christopher Cantwell is making Doom seem more relevant and relatable and such, and I never liked Doom because he was a mustache twirling villain. And then I turn around and complain that, you know, these villains here in Scumbag are too true to life. I don't know. There's got to be a happy balance in between. Scumbag, it's not for the faint of heart. I think it's one of those titles where you read it and right away you're going to know, yes, this is a book I want to continue to read, or no, this is absolutely disgusting and it's trash and I can't even believe he's allowed to make this. And I never, ever want to touch it ever again. So you're going to know, you're going to feel that way about either one way or the other about it right away. The art by Andrew Robinson, if you're familiar with his work, it's very recognizable as Andrew Robinson work. So it's great detail, great facial expressions, wonderful acting, especially some of the things Ernie does. Andrew illustrates them very successfully. I'll put it that way. Like if you're looking to gross somebody out, having Ernie do these things and then the way Andrew draws them, just, you know, gives you shivers. It's just so gross. So I personally, I'm 2 issues in, I'm going to give it one more to see if I'm going to hang around. It may be, and not that it's a bad comic, but it may just be one of those things where I just don't think I want to read something that's this gross. Or it might be a situation where I just kind of wait till it's over and then read it all at once so I can condense my sort of revulsion down into, you know, just a couple days of reading rather than reading short pieces and being just feeling revolted, you know, on a monthly basis.
So definitely interesting. I'd love to talk to Remender about what his thoughts were, like why put this out now, and how long he's had the idea and how much he may have had to even raise the stakes by putting it out now, as opposed to like 5 years ago before all the fake news and political stuff happened. All right, up next we have Flash number 766. This is the final installment, part four of With This Ring, written by Kevin Shinnick. The art is by Will Conrad. Colors are by Hi-Fi. Letters are by Steve Wands. I've talked the last two issues of Flash about what a great job Shinnick has done. I had my reservations with part one, but the last two issues, Shinnick has shown a really great skill of being able to take a classic rogues villain like Dr. Alchemy, level him up to the point where he's a legitimate threat to Barry Allen and the Flash. And he sticks the landing here. So often somebody becomes a threat, but then it doesn't pay off necessarily. Endings are hard a lot of times, you know, feel like they're much harder than beginnings. You know, you get the idea for a story, but how do you tie it all up so that it feels satisfactory and it doesn't feel like some kind of, you know, deus ex machina that the hero won the day? Everything here feels authentically Flash. It feels authentically Barry Allen. It feels classic, like those classic Flash stories from the early 80s, where it was almost Rogue of the Month, where he, you know, fight Heatwave for three or four issues, and then he was fighting Pied Piper, and then it was Golden Glider. This has all that. So I really am impressed with what Shinnick has been able to do. The art by Will Conrad is very traditional superhero art, very clean lines. Bright colors. I've talked before about what a great job the color palette is on these Shinnick issues by Hi-Fi, because Barry Allen is such a positive character. He's such an optimistic and upbeat character. You need those bright colors. And the other thing it does is by having the primary bright colors, it does give it that same classic feel of 80s Flash comics that were absolutely amazing. So really, really great job. I would highly recommend this four-part story by Kevin Shinnick to anybody who's a fan of the classic Barry Allen Flash, or even the classic Wally West, the Jeff Johns or Mark Waid stuff. This has that same sort of optimistic feel. And one last thing I'll say about the art with Will Conrad. One of the things I really loved, and obviously I don't know if this was Conrad or Shinnick that came up with this idea, we learned last issue about how Dr. Alchemy has sort of fused the Philosopher's Stone to himself, which then allowed the previous Dr. Alchemies of the past who had fused with the Philosopher's Stone to sort of take over his body. You know, all these different personalities or beings were kind of living in him. And to denote that in the art, when Conrad is drawing it, that it's a different version of Dr. Alchemy, you know, in this panel versus that panel. Some of them have reddish hair and a short beard. Some of them have long flowing white hair and a really long Merlin beard. And so it was one of those things that I noticed that was really cool. And then the regular Dr. Alchemy doesn't have any beard at all. So I loved that. And then you have some that have slightly different skin tone. So it's really cool that the art team gives us those little clues, those little visual cues, so that we know that it's not in the regular Dr. Alchemy, but rather one of the Dr. Alchemies that's taking over his body through the Philosopher's Stone. I thought that was a really cool little touch that they added in. All right, up next I have Undiscovered Country. This is issue number 10. It's written by Scott Snyder and Charles Soule. The art is by Giuseppe Camuncola. and Leonardo Marcello Grassi, colors by Matt Wilson and letters by Crank. We know that our intrepid team of explorers that have returned to the United States after it sealed itself off are in the second zone of the 13 zones or 13 colonies that are in the United States now, as they're following that spiral per the instructions of Uncle Sam. The zone is called Unity. It's the technology zone. In this issue, we learn a lot more about kind of the origins of Unity and what its goals were and what it hoped to accomplish. And we actually see Unity under attack. The most important thing we see in this issue is how Unity powers itself, how it finds a way to have enough power in this dystopian future to run all this technology. And it gets back to the question of that classic unanswerable question, do the ends justify the means? You know, we learn, as I said, what Unity did and what their original plans were, how those plans changed, how they felt like they were on the verge of a breakthrough that they were going to share with the rest of the colonies, and then figuring out how to actually make that happen or not happen, how it all actually played out in reality, and what the costs were of that. And then we're all left to wonder, was the price too high? And I'm sure that is going to be explored in issue 11, because when we see right at the end of this issue what's been done, you can't help but just inherently think, well, that's not okay. That's wrong on so many levels. So, you know, whether it's the first zone they were in, very Mad Max, very very dystopian, very very easy to look at that zone and say, people are suffering, this isn't right, there's not enough resources, and things have sort of fallen into disarray. And then you come to the second zone where, oh, people, you know, they have houses and everything is clean and shiny. You know, think of it as you know, that bright shining future of Star Trek, you know, where everything is clean and there's not a lack of resources. But then you find out, well, yeah, but in order to get there and in order to stay there, you've got to do some things that morally may not be okay. You know, how do you balance that? What's right? What's wrong? What's okay? What's not okay? You know, do the needs of the many outweigh the needs of the few? All those kind of questions like that are soon to come up, I think, in the next issue of Undiscovered Country. So again, another book that's very topical right now, especially with the pandemic and a lot of the United States being isolated. Like, I don't know if any countries in the world that we can just fly to right now without having to quarantine for 14 days because our numbers are so crazy. So, all right, up next I have Wonder Woman number 767. This is Max Lord's Revenge Part 2 from writer Mariko Tamaki. Pencils by Rafa Sandoval, inks by Jordi Tarragona, colors by Arif Prianto, and letters by Pat Brusseau. First, let me say, having Rafa Sandoval on the pencils is amazing. Nothing against Carlo Barbieri or Steve Pugh, but I just didn't feel like their art was the right style, wasn't clean enough, wasn't kind of quote-unquote superhero-esque enough for Wonder Woman. But I think Rafa does a really great job. So this is sort of the story that we've kind of been waiting for, or at least I've been waiting for ever since I saw Maxwell Lord show back up in the Wonder Woman title. Because that relationship between him and Diana, obviously there's a lot of history there, and we get resolution in this issue. I would almost say the issue is just one big fight in a way, but it's handled really well. And again, with that Rafa Sandoval art, a lot of big panels, a lot of dynamic panels, really gorgeous line work, great color work. I'm really glad they got Rafa to do this issue because it's really spectacular. The only thing I would nitpick about it is the preview page for next issue. It feels like we're taking a step backwards. Not sure what that's about, but I'm sort of ready to move on from this first story arc rather than prolong it. But it seems like we're going to be sticking with some of the same themes and same characters that we've seen so far. But I guess we'll have to wait and see. But yeah, best thing about this issue, seeing that that history from Wonder Woman and Maxwell Lord finally come to a head, and the Rafael Sandoval art spectacular as well. So this gives me hope that after quite a few mediocre issues, you know, it's not Mikel Yanin, but having Rafa, if he stays, I think it really elevates the book. But like I said, we're going to have to wait and see, because I'm definitely ready to move on and see what other characters Mariko Tamaki can bring in, because it's been a lot of the same so far. We're almost, 8 issues in? It'd be 9 issues by the time we see what she does. Hopefully wraps up everything with Maxwell Lord and such. So I guess we'll wait and see. All right, last book I'm going to talk about. It's my book of the week. It completely blew me away. It's 45 pages, and it's not a traditional comic in that there's not word balloons. So this is a bunch of text boxes and narration. It's the other history of the DC Universe. I guess the subtitle would be 1972 to 1995, Jefferson Pierce. For those who aren't aware, Jefferson Pierce is Black Lightning. The story is by John Ridley. Layouts are by Giuseppe Camuncoli. Finishes by Andrea Cucci. Colors by Jose Villarubia. And letters by Steve Wands. So what is really interesting and poignant and relevant and sad in a way and depressing, all those things, is this isn't just the history of the DC Universe from 1972 to 1995. And it's not just the history of Jefferson Pierce from those years. It's the history of this country in those years and the way that relates to Jefferson Pierce. And so, first of all, hats off to John Ridley, because he really did his homework in knowing the different eras and describing them in such a way. Not even him describing. It's again, this book is from the first person. It's Jefferson Pierce telling us the story, and it's Jefferson Pierce relaying to us those experiences. It's Jefferson Pierce telling us about his powers manifesting. It's Jefferson Pierce telling us about his marriage falling apart. It's Jefferson Pierce telling us about his joining the Outsiders and what that experience was like, and you know, eventually them breaking up. So it's the voice that John Ridley gives Jefferson Pierce in this story that feels so authentic. And by weaving in real events, it grounds the story and it makes it feel real. And the kind of the depressing and sad part is, here we are with this character of Jefferson Pierce, a Black man in America who, you know, starting in the 70s is talking about how disenfranchised he feels and talking about him seeing the rise of the superhero era, New Age, as it's called. And I have a feeling that phrase New Age comes up quite a bit in the beginning of the book. And I have a feeling that when you talk about 5G, that initiative or that story idea that Dan Didio was championing, that must have been this age was going to be called the New Age, the age that Jefferson Pierce is talking about. So that's probably a leftover
from that. But the thing that's sad and depressing is here we are 50 years later, 48 years later, 45 years later, whatever, however you want to put it. And we're still dealing with so many of the same things. And, you know, you would think in a country that's supposedly supposed to be as good as ours, that we would be beyond some of these things, you know. And if 2020 has taught us anything, it's that we're not. It's that racism is still there, and there's so many things that we still need to work on as a society. And so that's, as I said, some of the depressing parts of the story. But it's important. I think it's important to talk about those things. It's important to have those things shown to us and be reminded. And it's not all depressing. I mean, we see Pierce kind of come into his own and kind of come into some self-realization, which again, it's expertly done by Ridley, and it so perfectly encapsulates and gives context to the story of Jefferson Pierce. I think he's the perfect kind of a person of color as far as a hero to tell this story through because of what he's been through. So yeah, it's really good. And there were a couple of lines in the book, I'm flipping through it now, that really stood out to me. And really kind of drives the point home that I'm talking about, where, you know, for as far as we've come, yet here we are with us struggling, you know, some of these same, with these same battles. And so, the first line that I want to mention, Pierce's, kind of lamenting the loss of his wife and his children when they left him. And he talks about how, he gave up being, Black Lightning for a while, and you know, trying to find himself, and days were fine because he could lose himself in his day job. But when he was at home at night alone, he no longer had the role of Black Lightning to go out and perform and distract himself. He says, alone in my house at night, I would trip over things, not real objects, just pieces of a shattered past that lay scattered around me. And I think that, again, John Ridley doing an excellent job. I mean, that is a beautifully written line, and it gets right to the heart of who Jefferson Pierce is as a character, especially at that time. Because for whatever reason, Jefferson Pierce, and maybe it's because he's a street-level hero, and maybe it's because he's a person of color, and so writers have always felt like they could tell very realistic stories with him, but they always have done so. And I think that is a real credit to a lot of the characters that have written Black Lightning and written Jefferson Pierce in the past, from Tony Isabella on down. The other line that I wanted to mention is there's some passages in the book about Jefferson Pierce and John Stewart forging a friendship, talking about loss, talking about mistakes they've made, and Jefferson describing that moment of coming together, that moment of their friendship blossoming, and how it wasn't a moment where it's Black Lightning and Green Lantern coming together. It's not two heroes coming together. He says, we were just two men trying to figure out how to get out from under the shadow of our past and the burden of our race. And that phrase, burden of our race, really struck me. Because again, you know, John Ridley, an African-American man, a Black man, you know, he knows firsthand, certainly much better than me, about what it's like to live as a person of color in this country
and to have that burden of race. You know, I live life culturally on the easy setting when you think about it, right? Like, I'm white, I'm a male, I'm straight, or heterosexual, however you want to put it. So it doesn't really get, I mean, I'm not rich. That would be the final box that would really make my life easy mode. But I've never had to worry about the fact of my race being a burden. And that's just luck of the draw that I happen to be born white. And you know, that line from Ridley there in relation to John Stewart and Jefferson Pierce, man, their race, something they have absolutely zero control over. You're born to the parents you're born to, and you are that race. I can't imagine having your race be a burden. And so again, it lines like that that do something that I talk about all the time. It makes you think, it makes the story relevant, and more than anything, it reflects society. As I've said it 1,000 times, the fiction that societies tell and cultures tell, the make-believe stories they make up, says so much about who that society is at that time. And right now in 2020, like I said, I feel like in the last 4 or 5 years, we've taken a step back. I think a lot of us have had our eyes open to the fact that race is still such a burden in this country. We all thought it was getting better. We thought we were further down the road than we've been. And I know, and certainly in this episode, I've talked a lot about politics and a lot about politics in comics. And going back to the idea of, you know, art imitates life. And right now, politics is a big part of life in America. It's in your face all the time. And I feel like I never had to pay attention to politics as much as I have recently, because it's literally become a life and death thing. And it's sad. I don't want to think about politics. I don't enjoy politics. I don't enjoy the divisiveness of it. I don't enjoy hearing politicians on both sides lie to me and really just be out to line their pockets and make money while the rest of us are left to fight amongst ourselves. But getting back to the idea of using fiction to try to elicit change, to try to start conversations, to start uncomfortable conversations sometimes about things that we still need to address. At the end of the day, we are all of us humans are far, far, far more alike than we are different. You know, when you look at genetics and the way our bodies work and any kind of empirical metric that you want to use, you know, our DNA is going to be like 99.9999999% the same, you know, between me, a white guy, and some African-American guy. We are so much more alike than different, to the point where it's not even our differences genetically are not even statistically relevant. But I don't have burden of race and they do, and that's not right. And so I think it's important for our stories to start these conversations, for our stories to reflect these. And when you talk about the DC universe, you know, this iconic universe with characters like Wonder Woman and Batman and Superman known the world over, and DC trying to take an even more international tack these days. Let's take that universe that's known. Let's inject these real life events and see how these real life events can ground those heroes and reflect on those heroes and reflect on heroes like Black Lightning, who are still in that universe, but this is their history, thus the other history. Let's have the real life events ground those characters, bring realism to those characters, and then we can reflect back on what it says. What are these real life events and the things that are happening and the racism and the disenfranchisement? What does it say about how they affect Black Lightning and how Black Lightning reacts to those things. What do those events mean in the broader context of our society as they pertain to this fictional character? And then to take it a step further, what stories can we tell with that? What can we aspire to change? What can we see change in the story? And then we can pull inspiration from that and make real change. And I know I'm getting kind of deep and I know I'm getting kind of heady with these ideas, but I feel like that's the worth of the story. That's the point of the stories we tell. It's the point of a hero like Superman, right? He inspires us to be better than we can be on our own. Well, what's the worth here? What is Jefferson Pierce telling us? What is Black Lightning telling us? Well, in the words of John Ridley, as written here, he's telling us about the struggle. He's telling us about the burden of his race. We need to all have our eyes open. It's enough to be aware. To be aware that you can't ignore these things. You know, like I said, so many of us, myself included, I thought we were further down the path than we were. And the fact of the matter is, when you see persons of color, even in fiction, like Jefferson Pierce, talking about the burden of their race and the things that they are faced with on a day-to-day, it can start conversations. It can make us more aware. It can hopefully inspire change. So this absolutely had to be my book of the week. The art is spectacular. It's 45 pages. It is a good value because, as I said, there's no dialogue boxes. It's all, there's no word balloons, rather, no, or thought balloons. It's all dialogue boxes. Think of it much more like a graphic novel with prose. And so it's a good long read. And I think it's just done really, really well. The art is powerful. The color work is great. You've got some images in here that are very sort of iconic from other moments in DC history. Because again, this is it's history. It's telling a narrative over time of the DC universe, and so we're seeing things like Superman lift a car. We're seeing a very classic pose of John Stewart and Hal Jordan. There's a couple of Outsiders pages that are also very very familiar, I'll say. And so again, just really great job all around. The colors they're not real bright. It's not, you know, giving us this sense of optimism or this sense of, you know, classic superhero comics with bright primary colors. Because if anything, what comes across in the narrative as told in Jefferson Pierce's own words is that he sees himself as a man, an African American man first and foremost, and a hero second. And I've never been a big Black Lightning fan. Like, I certainly didn't watch the TV show or anything like that, even though it has actors that I like. But man, if this book didn't make me want to go and read all the Black Lightning and Jefferson Pierce history that I could get my hands on. So really, really great job by the entire creative team. Highly, highly recommend the other History of the DC Universe, issue 1. Can't wait for issue 2 to come out. So, all right, that was the last book I'm going to talk about. Let me give a rundown on some of the other titles you might want to be on the lookout for. From Aftershock Comics, we have Kaiju Score number 1. This is a heist story. Set in a Godzilla movie, to quote the solicitation. It's from James Patrick and Rem Brew. I really wanted to cover it, but there were just so many books I didn't get a chance to read it. So looking forward to checking that out. The other Aftershock book I want to mention is Sympathy for No Devils number 2 from Brandon Thomas and Lee Ferguson. I did talk about the first issue. I was unsure if I was on board for the series. So I wanted to read the second issue. But again, just like Kaiju, I just didn't get a chance to get to it. Ran out of time and needed to start recording. So from Boom, we have the second issue of Dune, House of Atreides. We also have Something is Killing the Children, number one foil variant that is out this week for local comic shop day. If you want to get your hands on a Something is Killing the Children, number one. We also have Unkindness of Ravens, number three from Dan Panosian. Over at Dark Horse for fans of The Witcher, there's a Witcher miniseries with its first issue hitting stands. It's called Witcher Fading Memories. At DC, in addition to the comics I already mentioned, we have Batman Beyond number 49, as that issue, that series heads to its conclusion. We also have Justice League Dark number 28, which wraps up the story that James Tynan initially started with the Upside Down Man. And then he had a lot of other stuff going on with Batman and Joker Warren. So he had to leave that title in the very capable hands of Ram V. But I saw James tweeting out that he felt like Ram V did a great job of wrapping up the story that he started. Legion of Superheroes, number 11 from Brian Michael Bendis. Suicide Squad number 11 from Tom Taylor, which is the final issue of that run. Over at Image, let me mention from IDW, we have the latest issue of Snake Eyes Dead Game from Rob Liefeld, which that is issue number three. Over at Image, in addition to the books I talked about, Department of Truth and Scumbag 2, we have Spawn number 312. Oh, and I also mentioned Undiscovered Country, number 10. From Marvel, we have Conan the Barbarian, number 16. We have Excalibur, number 15. The final issue of Falcon and Winter Soldier, number 5 of 5. There's a new Power Pack miniseries with the first issue hitting stands on Wednesday. And 10 of Swords Destruction, number 1, is out, continuing the 10 of Swords story. So those are just a few of the books that are on stands today that you might want to be on the lookout for. As always, I want to thank everybody for listening. As I mentioned at the top of the show, if you're traveling for the holiday, please be safe, wear a mask, wash your hands, and we'll talk to you next time.
You can find the Comic Source Podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, or whichever podcasting app you prefer. Please tell all your friends about us, subscribe, and rate us. The ratings really help with our visibility and our ability to reach new listeners, especially 5-star reviews on Apple. Also be sure to visit us at lrmonline.com to join the conversation, access the show notes, and discover all our other great pop culture content. If you want to email us, the email address is thecomicsourceblog@gmail.com, or you can follow us on Twitter, twitter.com/thecomicsource. Do a search for The Comic Source on Facebook and Instagram to follow us on those social platforms. All three spots are great places to find out when we release new episodes, as well as follow all our convention coverage. So once again, we want to thank everyone for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.